welcome to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. Your hosts today are Rob Loray and myself, Tanya Vitovic. While we are missing Jungle Jay, he'll be back in 2 weeks, and I want to say thank you to Frank Knox for answering the phone lines. Recently, we've discussed the problems that we have with safety in transportation here in Tampa Bay. We mentioned briefly that Tampa Bay was designed for cars, and we found out that engineering is the first thing that we go to for a solution. But should it be? Find out in the next hour what other options should be that we should be considering. Our guest, Joshua Frank, is a designer of spaces and is a founding principal at Wide Open Office. Joshua has a Master's of Architecture and a Master's of Urban and Community Design from the University of South Florida. Josh has a variety of experience in both in the built and natural environment, spanning in the fields of architecture, landscape planning, transportation, and urban design. Welcome, Joshua.
Thanks for having me.
So, Josh, you have worked on projects ranging from campus and municipal master planning to streetscape and public realm design throughout the Tampa Bay region and across the nation. When did the design of space become important to you?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, I started off my career at University of South Florida looking into architecture, and I think one of the biggest differences for me between sort of being an architect and being an urban designer is the difference between not only, you know, designing space interior to a building, but also for a greater purpose. And so one of the things that I really found to be inspiring and motivating is, you know, you could design the most beautiful museum or house or stadium in the country and have some incredible spaces inside, but if somebody in a wheelchair can't cross the street to get to its front doors and access it, for example, then it's really, you know, lost upon quite a bit of society. So really what I find to be my biggest driver is finding ways to make our shared environment better, whether it's natural, as you said, or built environment, or even cultural environment. I think however we can make that a better experience for everybody will make, you know, architecture and engineering and planning better for everybody.
That's awesome. I mean, I love the fact that you were thinking about accessibility for all, because they're really, in a lot of places, it's not accessible for everybody, especially folks with disabilities. And I love that you say that it's a shared environment, because it's true. Like, we have to all share this earth. And I think that's a part of sustainability, is just the ability to welcome everybody into it. So for me, when you say that, when you say engineers versus designers, in my mind, engineers think, can it be done? And designers think, should it be done? So what do you think are like the main differences between what happens when you have an engineer build something versus a designer being a part of the process?
So I actually think it's a bit of it's not so much versus as it is sort of a set of complementary professions. And so to me, you know, there's really, it's a three-legged stool. You have design, which I sort of put architects in that bucket, as well as landscape architects, interior designers, et cetera. You have planning, which is sort of the policy-related component to it, that, you know, how do we fund it? How do we regulatorily get it set up? Those sorts of things. And then there's the engineering leg to the stool, which is sort of how do we make it work? How do we make it efficient? How do we, how do we make it structurally sound? And so those three things, all of them are equally important. It's just a matter of which one sort of drives the conversation. Now, for example, I think that's different in a lot of different contexts. So if you're designing, say, a lunar module, then maybe the engineering and the life safety components is what takes the driver's seat in the overall, you know, design of something. Whereas if you were designing, say, a public park, then maybe the engineering takes the back seat to the design, because the biggest difference is what are you building these things for? And in a lot of cases, we see things that are being designed for people unfortunately, in my opinion, having sort of an engineered focus, which, you know, the biggest difference is engineers sort of are amazing people and are really great at what they do, but they're looking to solve for X, to be the most efficient, to save the most money. And sometimes it's worth breaking those rules a little bit, having a little bit of inefficiency if it means being safer for people, being more fun, being equitable. You know, there's a lot of times where we have to maybe break those rules on purpose. And so that's, you know, really to me one of the biggest differences.
And I love that you mentioned parks, because we have some issues with parks here and then also some issues with flooding. And we talked a little bit last week when we were preparing for the show when we brought up floodable parks. Or when there's a park in Chattanooga, Tennessee that that we discussed a little bit where, I don't know, I think you're familiar with the park, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So would you mind explaining to our listeners what is different about that park?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're seeing a lot in the profession, especially with sea level rise being a topic of you know, importance for how we design our public spaces and our public realm, you know, a lot of that three-legged stool, we're starting to see a lot of conversations between, say, planning and engineering or engineering and design. And one of the sort of cool, you know, things that we've seen lately, more so in Europe than in the United States for a lot of reasons, but, you know, in Chattanooga, for example, that park is a floodable park, which means it's designed to sort of be resilient in that it could flood during, you know, heavy rainfall events. Or if it's on the, I think it's on the Chattanooga River there downtown. So it may also be designed for high floodplain, 100-year storms, that sort of thing. But, you know, the engineering side of it, how much water it can hold, how fast can the water percolate back down to the water tables, that sorts of thing. Those decisions are being made in concert with the design, which is, okay, well, this is a place for people. How do we make it so that it's active and safe and beautiful and fun? And so those sides of things, that conversation is being happening at the same time from both parties. And what we're starting to see is that a lot of these new sort of relationships or new you know, typologies are starting to emerge. And these floodable parks is just one sort of example of that. But it makes for a pretty unique and fun experience, you know, compared to maybe just a either end of the spectrum in any case where you've got, you know, the engineered solution to that might just be a pond, a retention pond or a detention pond.
Or a big drain.
Yeah, or a big drain. And the design end of that might just be a very, you know, naturalized park environment. So, you know, not saying one's perfect and the other one's bad, but finding that middle ground between the two is really sort of interesting.
No, and I think that's where you come in, like the design aspect comes in. And just to give people an idea of this park, I mean, it was pretty incredible when we went on, when me and my family went to it. When it started raining, all of a sudden, the center of the park, which kind of just looked like a dip, turned into a river that kids could play in it. And it had the intention of kids playing in it with these large rocks inside. And it was really, the rain water wasn't a problem. It honestly made the park more fun when it actually did flood. So it was a really unique experience.
And serves as a function of our built environment, right? We have to hold that storm water. It has to be discharged. So we have to do those things anyway. Why not find a way to do it in a way that benefits people beyond, you know, sort of just an infrastructure perspective?
Absolutely. And I think that they even had a rain garden there too. Like, well, when this water ends up in the place where it's supposed to be, let's make it beautiful. Let's make it, you know, sustainable for this environment. I absolutely was in love with that one park. So when we look at your history in the Wide Open Office, and just to remind our listeners, you're listening to WMNF, this Sustainable Living Show. We have our expert, Josh Frank, who is a designer of spaces and is a founding principal at Wide Open Office. If you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. So you did a project, I think, working with Civitas in the University of California in San Diego, and there was a project that you worked on that received LEED Gold status for utilizing different techniques of water capture and cleansing. So can you explain a little bit about what LEED is and why it is beneficial for design?
Sure. So LEED is a supplementary piece of design, you know, that's not required in a lot of places, but in some places it's becoming required. But it stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And essentially, you know, the quickest explanation is LEED is sort of an environmental checklist that's always growing and expanding and innovating in a way that if you're building, say, a building or designing a site or a park, you can apply for LEED certification by checking this list and saying, yes, we did this. You know, we recycled our construction materials. We only used building materials within a 5-mile radius of the site or whatever it is. It changes all the time. But, you know, those sorts of sustainable elements to a project, you check those off and then you submit, and however many you've met, you will get a certification for. So it's bronze, silver, gold, platinum, and, you know, really you want to try and shoot for the highest you can get, but that's essentially what it is in a sort of 30-second answer.
No, that's... thank you.
Yeah, no problem. It's actually becoming... there's not only is there LEED certification, but now we're seeing things like WELL certification, which those of your listeners who may be familiar with the Water Street District is planned, I think still planned to be one of the world's first WELL certified districts. So,
can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so WELL is sort of an equivalent to LEED, but for health. So health and well-being. So, for example, which is ultra relevant now, one of the elements of WELL that they've looked at is, say, door handles being made out of antimicrobial materials, right? So those sorts of minutia, down to bigger topics, macro topics of, you know, is this district walkable? And so there's a lot of different metrics for how you can quantify walkable, but WELL is sort of the public health and the mental health side of things being more important, say, than just a standard building.
And I think Rob maybe might have a question for you too.
Sure.
So, Josh, thanks for coming on the program. Our guest is Joshua Frank, a designer of spaces and founding principal at the Wide Open Office. He has a Master's of Architecture and Master's of Urban Community Design from the University of South Florida. And this is 88.5 FM. Josh, I want to get to something that you're famous for and ask you about it. You've been on M&F several times talking about your idea to really tear down the interstates that go through the center of Tampa and replace them with street-level traffic. And I just wondered, you proposed that idea, and there was a lot of pushback, especially from people that support the interstate system. What happened to that idea?
Well, thanks for the question. You know, it's funny because that conversation and that project is sort of a spin-off of the larger conversation which we're having today, which is, you know, a very important, I think, the difference between engineering solutions and design solutions. And, you know, so as things stand sort of right now, you know, that project has been, presented. I've presented it to all three NPOs, bunch of citizen groups, neighbor associations, that sort of thing. I'm open for bar mitzvahs too, apparently. You know, that right now, the last thing that happened, obviously with the coronavirus, things have been pushed back, across most agencies, but as it stands today, the last major milestone was that the our project was and our interstate was included in the top 10 from the Congress for New Urbanism's Freeways Without Futures report, which says it's been peer reviewed and they agree that it is a candidate to be replaced with surface level boulevard, but also transit. That's a big component. And so we've been included nationally, but also the Hillsborough County MPO has unanimously approved further study. So it's being included in future work programs, that sort of thing, for a greater look, a second look. So, and I welcome that. I'm enthused.
Josh, I want to ask you about how it would work, but before we do that, There have been places around the country where interstates that go through the center part of the city have been torn down, and I'm thinking of Seattle and the Alaskan Highway that goes along the waterfront in Seattle. And I wonder if you're familiar with that, and then what's happened since they tore it down?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Alaskan Way Viaduct is probably the best and most recent example. Others would be Portland, Milwaukee, Boston, you name it. It's San Francisco. There's a lot of major metropolitan areas that are starting to reevaluate their interstate infrastructure. But in Seattle, their scenario is a bit unique. Everyone's a little bit different, obviously, but not only were they able to remove the viaduct, which was a double-decker highway that cut off their waterfront, but they were able to replace it with a surface-level boulevard and a significant public park on the waterfront. So, you know, I've seen a lot of photos of it coming down. It's been sort of really interesting to see Seattle from a different perspective now without this sort of, you know, major barrier between the downtown and the waterfront. But the success right now, really we've seen a lot of increased walkability, increased bike usage. I believe there was a study done during the shutdown of the viaduct prior to construction that said bike usage was up significantly. I want to say like 200-300%. And, you know, the biggest lesson being that we see these, you know, car apocalypse types of you know, news stories about, you know, the 405 in LA shutting down and car apocalypse happening. And what ends up happening is people find an alternative, and the city doesn't shut down, you know, whether it's working from home or biking. I think, you know, we start to see these major successes. And that's just, you know, from a public standpoint. The private investment around that corridor for development, you know, I believe last I saw was the land transactions over since the project was announced about 10 years ago was enough to pay for the removal, the new road, the new park, and still have, I think, like $3 billion left over. So, you know, it's not only a good for the public, but it's definitely an economic opportunity as well.
We're talking about what to do with our public spaces, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and Joshua Frank is our guest, and right now we're talking about what it would be like if we tore down the interstates through the center part of Tampa. Josh, let's just do a scenario. If somebody's driving from Brandon and they work maybe in the northern part of St. Petersburg and they take I-4 for part of their journey and then get on 275 south, or if you're in St. Petersburg and you travel in the morning to Lutz for your job or the University of South Florida, could you describe if we tore down the interstates, what would it be like? I mean, right now, that trip from St. Pete to Lutz probably takes an hour during prime rush hour. Wouldn't it take longer, and wouldn't people be more frustrated by the traffic situation? Tell us, you know, what do you think would happen if we tore down the interstates?
Sure. So I'll start by saying, you know, the first thing is that the section that I looked at and that is under consideration is from the downtown interchange, Malfunction Junction, to the interchange at 75. So in everything we've looked at, you know, that's really the lowest hanging fruit. I-4 would remain the same. 275 east-west with the Howard Franklin Bridge would remain the same. And for the most part, in Pinellas County, it would remain the same. Although I would posit that right now FDOT is sincerely looking themselves at removing parts of 175 and 375 in St. Petersburg. So it is a conversation that even FDOT will have internally about some of these pieces. So, but to answer your question, you know, one of the things I looked at as part of this is it's not as simple as sort of cut and paste. It's not there anymore, and instead we have a boulevard. It's the whole success of having 275 be removed, that segment, is that we have a robust transit system in place beforehand, where you know, that person who's driving from Brandon is driving next to 10 other people who may be going somewhere that we can capture their trip into transit, as opposed to having them drive. So if you have to drive, that's fine, you can still do it. But the greater goal is to try and to reduce the total number of trips. And the only way you can do that is with transit. So that's the first step. The second step is if you're driving from Brandon, you still have alternatives into the St. Pete area. So if you're taking I-4, I think that's actually this segment, removing the segment actually makes that trip better for you, because one of the biggest headaches is malfunction junction. That's what sort of backs things up in every direction. And we've tried to fix it. FDOT's tried to fix it 3 times. It's an unsolvable problem, because the more lanes you have, the more cars you're going to have. So the real solution to malfunction junction is to not have a junction. And so for those folks going west on I-4, instead of having to deal with, you know, people merging and weaving and trying to get off or go north or go west, you now have a straight shot through, and your commute may actually be a few minutes faster because of that. So that combined with, you know, converting as many trips to transit as we can, and I would also say adding a smarter land use policy, so that if you have to go to the pharmacy, that maybe there's a pharmacy within walking distance, as opposed to having to drive to one. Those decisions in concert with removing the interstate have to happen. But, you know, really the goal is to make commute times as fast as possible. And the only way we can do that is with transit and smarter land use. Only then can we start talking about taking the interstate off.
Well, I don't think the end goal for me is the commuter times as less as possible. I think that it's about the enjoyment. But I do want to remind our listeners of that you're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa 88.5. Our guest today is Joshua Frank. He is a designer of spaces and a founding principal at Wide Open Office. If you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. When you're talking about 275, and the highways in general, it seems to me that design seems to do something that engineering does not. It is not solving for one purpose, but is taking the whole into concern and consideration. But does design sacrifice efficiency for a greater purpose? And then, even if it does that end up leading to a better space and a better product, in your opinion?
Yes, I think you're totally right. So to put it in the context of 275, for example, that north-south corridor between downtown and USF is, inherently unpleasant being on the interstate, right? It's not only is it dangerous, not only does that corridor have more pollution, air pollution and fine air particulates than other parts of the city and the county, but it also has more noise pollution, which impacts your quality of life, your quality of sleep. So we see things from elevated blood pressure and cardiovascular disease rates to having higher rates of diabetes within a 2-minute radius of the interstate. And unfortunately, most of that is in our minority populations in the city and county. And, it's a very timely conversation that a lot of planners and designers are having, because we're starting to reconcile, I think, with that bigger picture, not only just in terms of health and metrics, but also in terms of equity. And I don't know if there's excellent answers yet. If anybody's had the ability to, really come to a conclusion that works for everybody yet. But one of the things that I've observed with this whole project is that corridor was put there on purpose, and it was purposefully done to displace Black and brown communities in Tampa. A lot of the land that the interstate was built on was redlined, and a lot of it was, done so because there was the agency that put it in place knew there wasn't going to be resources enough to fight it. And so part of the reason why the interstate, zigs and zags and snakes the way it does is because it was, easier to acquire this person's property versus somebody else's property. And so, that bigger picture view of, okay, how do we improve those folks' quality of life and their economic mobility and their access to certain things in life that other folks may not have is just as important as moving X number of cars per day, if not, I would say, more important than the engineering side of things. So that, in my opinion, is where designers and urban designers like myself need to step in and say, you know, it's okay for us to be 2 minutes less in drive time if it means we're going to give these folks a chance at home ownership and not having cardiovascular diseases and that sort of thing. But from a purely engineering standpoint, that conversation almost never happens.
Why do you think it never happens?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of reasons. One of the things that I'm really, you know, passionate about is all three prongs of that stool, design, planning, and engineering, engaging with one another more. You know, I sort of float in between all three of them as an urban designer, but I know engineers who know very little about planning policy. And I know urban planners who maybe know very little about building design. And so there's very little cross, you know, pollination between all three. And I think we could all benefit from sort of understanding those sides of things a little bit better. You know, it's hard to do because our educational processes are very siloed, but, you know, I think that's something that would be a good start to sort of address that.
And when you talk about, I mean, when you separate the communities, when you're talking about living next to a highway, separating the communities is one thing. Your value of your house is another. But when you talk about air pollution and noise pollution, do you think that we take into consideration when we alter the ecosystems like this and what the effects are?
I think we do more now than maybe we did in the 50s and 60s, which is when most of our interstate system was built, at least here in Tampa. But, you know, at the same time, those same levels of fine air particulates and noise pollution happened with the Selman, and that was built in the 80s. And is being talked about, there's conversations now about expanding it as well. So, you know, it's a question that I think, unfortunately, most people don't recognize. I mean, obviously, if you've ever stood next to an interstate, you know it's loud and you know it's disgusting in a lot of ways. And if you live next to one, unfortunately, you've dealt with having to brush the black soot off of your porch or your front door or window.
In your lungs.
You know, yeah, exactly. And you've, you know, had to deal with poor air quality your whole life if you live there. But, you know, it's something that I don't think everybody associates.
It seems like we're making the same mistake over and over again then. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. And especially, I think one of the things that's unique about Florida in a lot of ways, as maybe some of the other states, is that we have such a high floor to overcome when it comes to our water tables, our rain events, our emergencies with hurricanes, that sort of thing, that the engineering side of things kind of always gets the default deference to these types of projects. Whereas, you know, maybe in a state that is a little bit less volatile and doesn't have, you know, poor soils or poor drainage or all these other sorts of things, maybe has a little bit more leeway to do more design. But it's something that I think is desperately impacting pretty much every facet of our lives because, you know, this engineered mindset drives everything from where developers develop their subdivisions to, you know, how land is, you know, either preserved or developed to the quality of the water, right? I mean, seeing these algae blooms, a lot of them are because of where we've placed our farmland and where our suburban, you know, developments have occurred. And so, again, it's a systematic I would say systems-based approach is something that needs to be discussed a lot more amongst our agencies, but amongst our professionals as well.
Now, that's a really good point. Do you think that when we are designing, do we have an obligation to make this space that we, when we design in outside, habitable for wildlife to survive there as well as a part of having a healthy ecosystem?
I think so. I mean, I would hope so. I think that, you know, to a certain extent, that's unavoidable. I think life will kind of always find its way, especially in Florida where everything grows. And it's hard to avoid. I mean, if you have a front lawn or a back backyard, you know how hard it is maybe to keep certain plants out, and that's great. Florida is resilient in a lot of ways to that degree. But, you know, I do wish that I would see a lot more native and a lot more flexibility for sort of wildlife in our, especially in our urban areas. The suburban areas tend to do a little bit better with that, I think, in a lot of ways. But, you know, it's a systems-based approach where I think, you know, one person doing it maybe isn't dropping the bucket, but really it needs to be a larger approach, and maybe that's where, you know, the design side of things may think that, but then it's the planning leg of the stool. How do we get that into policy? How do we make sure that there's a requirement with new development or something like that?
Well, if you've got a question for our guest, Joshua Frank, who is a designer of spaces and founding principal at Wide Open Office, you can call us at 813-239-9663. Also, our email address, if you want to email us, is dj@wmnf.org. Josh, before we leave this topic, and you and Tanya brought it up, fine air particulates. I've been reading in the British press the last few years how they're very concerned about what happens when a lot of cars, millions of cars, pass over a roadway and turn the concrete into dust that rises in the air and then gets in people's lungs. It's become a big issue for health scientists in England. They're trying to prevent this from happening. Tell us what do you know about the health danger of cars creating this dust, these fine air particulates? What kind of health danger is, you mentioned diabetes a moment ago, but what other health danger is there to breathing in this dust?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know a lot of specifics about the fine air particulates, but one of the things that, you know, bothers me the most is not only, I haven't heard about the concrete dust, but that's obviously something that would make a ton of sense, but one of the ones I have heard about and that I know is, if not, I wouldn't say it's worse. I mean, they're all bad. But, you know, one of the things that I've seen lately is that we're actually finding, the scientific community that is actually finding that one of the biggest contributing factors to pollution in our water bodies and eventually in our food systems is degrading tires. So if you think of every car that has four tires on it, you know, the old trick about putting your penny in and seeing Abraham Lincoln's head with the tread. Every time you have tread that wears down, that turns into fine particulates as well. And that is something that maybe you can't see is being washed with rain into the stormwater system. And I've pretty much seen a lot of research that essentially that rubber, that disintegrated rubber is ubiquitous in our water bodies and even in our personal bodies as we ingest fish and other sorts of things. So that combined with microplastics and fine air particulates, you know, associated with our cars, just our cars in our roadway system is, you know, really, really alarming. And I think, you know, that's just the sort of scientific end of what we know. One of the sort of societal components is, you know, diabetes. I mentioned diabetes. It's because folks aren't able to walk to a corner store as they once were. So if you think about that en masse, because of how dangerous our roadways are, how wide the intersections are, how we have sort of, you know, incentivized people to drive as opposed to walk, they are walking less and therefore having higher rates of cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, all these sorts of things. So it's sort of a compounding issue and it may be a secondary issue, but an issue that's related to this nonetheless. And so that's one of the things, you know, about the Boulevard project is that one of the benefits to having a surface level road as opposed to this elevated road is I feel like part of this could be incentivizing our urban core neighborhoods to become the 15-minute city, the 5-minute city, where I don't have to drive to go to a hardware store or a pharmacy, or if I have kids, they can walk to school. Or if I wanted to go pick up a loaf of bread, I could do that. And so really it's not a romanticized version of going back to the 1950s and 40s. But really, it's a way of getting our built environment right-sized so that we incentivize folks to be active, which, you know, costs us less in terms of health care costs and all these other sorts of things. So, you know, that to me is just as important and terrifying as the fine air particulate side of things, which is also extremely terrifying.
Well, if you've got a question for our guest, Joshua Frank, email us here in the studio. The address, dj@wmnf.org. So, Josh, you're an expert in urban and community design. Do you have a favorite place here in Florida where you think it's walkable, it's healthy, the cars don't take over, and you're not in fear of cars and trucks, and it's the kind of thing that we should aspire to? Is there a community that you like here in Florida?
Well, I may be a little biased, but I lived in Ybor City for 3 years, and I serve on the YCDC, the Ybor City Development Corporation, as a community on the community board. And I think Ybor City is probably one of our finest examples of walkable urbanism. It certainly was when it was at its peak in the teens and 20s and 30s. But today, the core of Ybor, I think, is one of the most incredible places to live, work, and walk. I was fortunate enough to be there when Kiko was running the streetcar pretty much every 15 minutes. And so it was like riding, you know, transit in any other metropolitan area, as opposed to maybe more of a tourist-oriented function. And so for that bit of time that I lived there, that was, to me, probably as good of an urban environment as you'll find in Tampa. And, you know, that was an instance where I could walk to the corner store and grab milk, or, you know, we were trying to make cookies or brownies and we needed flour or something, and you could go and do that. And, you know, that's not something that you can really do in West Chase or you know, Fishhawk Ranch or some of these other places that maybe are out in the suburbs. And so that's not to say that those places are bad. I happen to believe that an infusion of more walkable commercial and retail, you know, into some of those areas would be beneficial. But and you can fix it. There's a fantastic book called The Sprawl Repair Manual that talks about how we can take some of these exurbs and suburban communities and really start to inject a lot of that walkability into them. But for right now, for me, you just can't beat Ybor City. The combination of its function and its beauty and history is just unmatched in our region.
So Lou writes this. He says, Tanya and Joshua, I like the discussion. My question is, what can be done to discourage long commutes? It seems like a good start to clear the air. Perhaps eliminating the I-275 corridor would be an interesting beginning, writes Lou.
So that's a great question. I think, you know, for one, if we've learned anything from this coronavirus and COVID pandemic, is that there is and should be a greater flexibility between our employers and our employees to working from home. You know, I've done it. My wife has done it. I know everybody, a lot of my friends have done it, and some of them won't be going back to a workplace, or at least not full time. And so that, as a flexibility in and of itself, I think we saw, I've asked for the data, I don't know if I've got it yet, but about just car trips during, you know, the March, April, May sort of peak. And my instinct is that they'll be at least half of what they were. I think, you know, my family's been in this area since the 60s and 70s. And I can't remember my parents ever telling me, you know, it was easy to drive somewhere. And especially not in the last 10 or 20 years. And so I think it was as a tangible benefit to sort of folks, you know, working from home, maybe walking a little bit more to some of their locations. And then I would say that those longer commutes, to me, are some of the lower hanging fruit for converting folks to transit. And so, you know, obviously, if this isn't a social experiment where everybody's going to all of a sudden get on a train, it's providing an alternative. And I think if you make that alternative attractive enough, that long commute won't be a headache of 45 minutes. It'll be 25 minutes on a train where you can maybe, you know, read the newspaper or do a little bit of work on your way in or, you know, listen to music, whatever. And I think that combination, it's a lot of different answers. I've said this before, maybe not on the radio, but I don't believe in silver bullets. I believe in silver buckshot. So I think, you know, thinking about a way to tackle something in 15 different ways is probably the right way to do it. So those are maybe just a handful of examples.
So, and Tanya, we got a caller.
Absolutely. So David from Valrico, you're on.
Hi, David. Valrico, what's your question?
I was listening to your discussion about concrete dust being created. I'm a construction safety guy. And silica dust that you get when you grind and saw and otherwise make hardened concrete into dust is a respirable hazard that embeds itself in your lungs and can cause silicosis from prolonged long-term damage or, you know, exposure to it. It's not something that you can get from a very short exposure. You know, I'm not a industrial pulmonary physician, but there's you know, employees that are, you know, exposed to that at the workplace are required to, you know, wet cut, provide engineered solutions to minimize the amount of concrete dust that you inhale and that gets embedded in your lung tissue and can cause trouble over long periods of time.
Yeah, it causes scarring of your lung tissue. So David, how dangerous? I mean, are you seeing coworkers come down with lung cancer or anything else who've had long-term exposure?
No, but I do a lot of, there's a lot of training that's required because it's real easy for OSHA compliance officers and safety professionals to walk jobs, and when they see somebody saw cutting concrete and they see a cloud of dust, they know they're not providing engineered solutions. So I've been doing this for over 30 years, but I've never met someone who has had silicosis. But I do know from my training that it's a long-term, you know, that's very painful, and it's not a good disease to get, you know. It's, and they're finding that, you know, there's a lot of nanoparticles that construction workers are exposed to. But I don't want to go off in the deep end here on that subject. I just wanted to try to tie your conversation to some real-world, you know, concerns that, I don't know what the numbers are of exposures on the highway when concrete dust is put in the air, but OSHA has set limits to what those safe limits to what somebody can breathe over a work shift, if you follow what I'm saying.
No, absolutely. And I don't know if OSHA has done any studies along the highway. It is definitely something that it seems like we should be looking into, because those fine particulates, you know, they get into your bronchial, and they're small enough to get into your alveoli, and they will cause respiratory distress over time. I mean, it's something that, you know, when we talk about, you know, the health of the community that's in these areas that are cut off, not only, like you said before, Josh, that they're in a food desert. They have diabetes because they don't have the walkability and the connection. And, you know, 30% of our community, they don't drive. So if they have no ability to get out of their community, then they can't actually eat healthy. And then if these particulates are also causing them lung damage, they're obviously, their health is at risk.
Yeah, it's also a complicated, you know, sort of balance, because part of the reason the interstate, you know, has created sort of this corridor of issues is because it was built on top of Central Ave. And so, you know, that was sort of the center of the city. And that has depressed property values, which has, you know, brought, for example, in my neck of the woods in Seminole Heights, you have a contrast or a, you know, sort of complicated relationship between some of these legacy buildings and areas like, say, Hillsborough High School, which is right, you know, half a block away from the interstate and has 800 kids, you know, however many their student body is there all day, you know, almost all day, every day during the school year. And you've also got, you know, some of these developers who come in and bring a, you know, family value type place, which is useful for the folks who live there, but is only there because they perceive sort of a market that will need it. And so how do you elevate that area back up to proper home values so that those folks can, you know, get out of this cycle, but also, you know, bring down the fine air particulates in an area that, you know, these folks are going to suffer. There's a lot of research that basically says your zip code determines your health more than almost any other thing.
No, that's so really, that's interesting. And I just want to...
That's a product of our built environment.
Thank our caller so much for calling in with a great with some great information. And I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. If you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. And we actually have an email from David. He says, "Hi, Rob. I tuned in late, so forgive me if I mention this. I live in Seminole Heights, about four blocks from I-275, and have an old bungalow. I love living there, but one weird thing is that I've never encountered elsewhere is that there is a constant black dust that settles on my porch and the rest of the house. Is this dust from the soot of car exhaust and the disintegrating rubber from tires on the highway? Thank you, David." Well, I think that, David, that brings up exactly what we're talking about.
So I would say, I'm not, you know, obviously short of doing a chemical test, I would say about 9 out of 10, 95, 97% certainty that, yes, that is from not only the interstate in general, but it's probably a combination of exhaust. It's probably a combination of that, the disintegrating tires, you know, you name it, that you're not alone. I also live in Seminole Heights in an old bungalow, so I understand the love that comes with living in a house that's almost 100 years old. But, you know, living within those two blocks of the interstate, you're going to have a higher rate of fine air particulates for sure. And that's whether we should do another show sometime about dispelling myths. But, you know, whether or not there are sound walls, they make almost zero to negligible difference on pollution, both noise pollution and air pollution. And a common sort of rationale for expanding the interstate is that the cars will move as opposed to sitting still and idling. Well, idling, yes, does produce more emissions than moving, but it's more cars also produces more emissions. So, you know, it's a bit of a false choice. So, you know, I've sympathized with David, the emailer, but unfortunately that's the reality that we've had created for us.
And David, I would love if you actually had some of that soot tested to find out exactly what the components are, what it's, you know, what it's made out of, and find out if it is soot, if it is rubber, what is this dust? Because I don't live close to a highway and I don't really have that dust. But, I mean, it is interesting because I work sometimes close to where we burn our trash in Ybor, and there is a nasty, oily soot that is on everything, from the buildings to your cars. And a lot of the people that work down there, they do have respiratory issues. Like, these fine particulates are having an effect on our health. So, I mean, David, if you want to test that, that'd be great.
We unfortunately have a lot of schools around our interstates as well.
Absolutely.
So that's, to me, even more concerning, is because obviously impacts are bad no matter who you are, but if you're young and your lungs are still developing, it can be life-altering, the amount of pollution that you can incur, basically, by living next to an interstate or being at school next to an interstate. Or, you know, it's what makes me laugh when I see basketball hoops and stuff being proposed for being underneath the interstate or a farm or urban farm or something like that, because nobody should be eating or breathing within you know, 500 feet of the interstate.
No, that's a really good point. And so in general, I mean, it seems like these interstates, they're doing more harm than good. So I really like your the proposal for 275. Sorry, it took up a lot of the show, but I appreciate the conversation. So in your mind, what is a sustainable community look like to you? Because you're a designer, like what in your mind do you picture?
Well, one of the things, I think it's a combination of the little, incremental changes combined with the big aspirational visions. And I think you need both. For example, I live on a street that doesn't have sidewalks. And that's a big difference, especially now that folks maybe are outside because they're cooped up in their house all day. They're getting outside, they're seeing their neighborhood for the first time, and maybe they're having to walk in the street and understand just how important little things like sidewalks and curbs and streetlights are. So to me, a sustainable city understands that, yes, those little things are super important. They may be concrete, but they're important. And then the bigger aspirational sides of things, I think, are what makes a sustainable city, is a willingness to admit and correct past wrongs. And so, yes, the interstate is a key function of our everyday society here in Tampa and around the country in the United States and even the rest of the world. Interstates have a huge impact economically, socially, you name it. But I think also, it's valuable for us to question their use and whether or not they actually are a net benefit. I happen to believe they aren't. And so, that's one thing, is admitting you have a problem is the first step, right? The second step is to trying to find a way to rectify that. And so, that's what I've attempted to do. And I think a sustainable city should question itself and be willing to make change. Cities, I think, inherently are organisms. They change, they evolve. A bad neighborhood one day is a good neighborhood the next. And, we should understand that those things too can change. So I'm not afraid to question them, but I think our agencies and citizens should be interested in thinking about that way too.
That's all amazing points. Thank you so much. And if our listeners have any questions for you and want to contact you, what is the best way for them to do that?
So the easiest way is Twitter. So my Twitter handle is @JoshAFrank. That's JoshAFrank. And that's the easiest way.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Josh, for being on the show. I appreciate it. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And I just want to say that on Midpoint Monday, Sean Canaan will talk about the legacy of the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and what comes next for the court and for America.
All right, Josh, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks, and Tanya, thank you. See you in 2 weeks. This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. You've been listening to the Sustainable Living Program. Stay tuned for the news and radioactivity.